We are going to go in order of the agenda today, and we're going to start off with a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 1527. Administrator Donovan, can you give us a quick summary?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1527 directs the Oregon Business Development Department to contract with public or private entities to develop a dislocated worker training program as a pilot program to enable unemployed and underemployed engineers and industry professionals in bioscience and manufacturing to be reemployed in Oregon. It does have a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and we have two members here to talk about it today.
Senator Devlin and Representative Gallegos, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. Before I start into my prepared testimony, I would like to talk a little bit about technology, because I think sometimes in this state we have a perception that technology in the state and biotechnology is only found in the Sunset Corridor. And I can understand that perception, but the reality is there are companies all over this state. There are companies most of us don't actually even know about. In fact, I found out about one only a few weeks ago that I didn't know about. Now, I've always known about a company that was in my district named Novellus, that now has been acquired by Ant Lamb Industries. You would probably have an idea what Novellus might do if you knew the name. Novellus produces the machines that actually put the circuitry on the wafers. And they actually serve an international clientele, and they have operations in several different states and actually in several different countries. But I did not know about a small, not really that small, when you can look, consider the full size of the company, but in my district, in a nondescript, single-story, Class B, is what I normally call it, industrial park, exists an operation for Biotronics. Biotronics is one of the world-leading producers of a number of different things for medical technology. And at that particular facility in the Lake Grove portion of Lake Oswego, they produce actually the technology, the electronic portion of pacemakers, which I don't believe any of you wear now, right now, but some of us might have to wear them in the future. And they also produce, the chair had, no, has taken an interest in this issue before, they produce defibrillators, but actually implanted defibrillators, which I did not actually know knew existed before I took a tour of the company. I'd be wouldn't even have to ask the question, but I think any of you that wanted to visit that company would be more than welcome to. But I think it was a reality check that actually a lot of these companies exist. We don't see them very often, but they all have a similar issue, and that's trying to find trained workers that can work in their particular areas. And as technology evolves, actually workers need to be retrained. And that's why I'm here to talk about SB 1527. This bill, which I would characterize not as a major bill, it's a modest bill, is an opportunity to put unemployed and underemployed Oregonians back to work in high-wage jobs and help fill open positions in Oregon's bioscience and advanced manufacturing industries. It will establish a workforce pilot program that will utilize an existing industry-driven education framework that has been in existence for more than 4 years, is proven, and has trained more than 1,600 workers. The pilot will consist of a two-week professional immersion program to provide 100 Oregonians the extra education they'll need to be employable in bioscience and advanced manufacturing. The pilot will be available statewide, and there will be no charge to those who receive training through the program. If successful, this same type of program could be used for other workers and industries as they experience cyclical growth and contraction in industries. I think the realities of actually having to retrain people, we're not actually talking about retraining people here, you know, that have a few years of college credit. We're talking about people that are already engineers, but because of changes in technology, actually need to get some of their training upgraded to be reemployed. People that when reemployed will actually obviously be earning fairly good incomes. The off-spin from those incomes will actually be creating more jobs in this state, and actually will be putting more people actually not on the need side of our equation in terms of need for state services, but on the plus side of actually producing in this state and being the productive citizens that they all want to be. I'm here with my good colleague, Representative Gallegos, who I believe has more to say than I do. And I will conclude it at that. And we actually have some other people to testify that know far more about the technicalities of this particular bill than I do.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Gallegos. For the record, Joe Gallegos, representative from House District 30, which is the Silicon Valley or the Sunset Corridor, as mentioned. So obviously, my constituents there are many of the engineers that would be affected by this program. You know, I just have a couple of things to say. I think I'll be a lot shorter than the senator. This industry is amazing. As is mentioned, the defibrillators, out of these manufacturers come equipment to save our military out in the field. Also, equipment that is used in hospitals for premature babies, those kinds of things. It's a tremendously a fast-growing industry. It's grown like over 30% in the last decade. So I think, you know, it's something that we would want to support. As the senator mentioned, the average wage actually is around $80,000 a year. Much more than senators and representatives make, but it's very good. And I think a really important point about this particular project is that it will enable unemployed engineers to get retrained so that they're employable again. But more than that, I think it would help us to hire Oregonians and our local folks rather than going out of state or bringing in international engineers to fill our job needs. So I think in those ways, it's a great bill. And again, hopefully we can support it. Thank you.
Thank you both. This bill has a referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Senator, I know you know people down there. There's a $250,000 number in this bill. Is that a placeholder? Is that what it will be? Is that what we will be voting on?
That is the number that's been requested. For the advocates for the bill that will speak after us, I have not promised anyone any appropriation for the bill at this point. Actually, I haven't promised much of anyone any appropriation for anything.
That's true. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator and Representative, I guess, I think this is a great idea. I think it's a great pilot to do. I just had the question of why Business Oregon rather than the State Workforce Investment Board? And that's sort of their business that we chartered them to do.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, I can't probably answer that question directly, but if I had to guess, I would say Workforce Development does a lot of great work. But it's a much more diffuse organization. I think Business Oregon could take something like this, simply administer it, simply, monitor the actual activities and the actual performance. It's something that's I just think fits pretty well into Business Oregon's sort of portfolio of activities. Longer term, if you wanted to do this in other areas, I think it might more appropriately move over there. You know, if I might comment, Mr. Chair, if I have a second here. I was recently acquainted with a program in Idaho a few months ago where I'm not advocating for this program, but what they do there is that they allow some employers that have very good records in terms of retention of employees but have been paying unemployment insurance, obviously, for a very long time, that when they have changes in terms of what products they are producing and they have to retrain people, they're able to actually recoup some of that revenue that they've actually put into the unemployment insurance pool to work largely with their local community colleges to retrain people so they're not constantly laying off people or losing contracts. And I think there are a lot of things that we could do a little bit more creatively in this area to keep people employed.
Yeah, I would like to just add that one of the things I really like about this particular project is a mixing of private and public funds. I mean, I think that's a kind of partnership that we want to encourage. I'd also, someplace in the one pager, I saw that at $80,000, just training a small number of these individuals will kick back what we've spent in terms of recoup taxes and so on. So, yep.
Well, thank you both. I assume your comments are also in support of the Dash 1 amendment to this
yes.
bill.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. I could call up three people here, Dennis McNanny, Adrian Poliak, and Tim McGahn.
Would you? Tim McGahn's mistake. Well, I didn't mean that.
Welcome to the Capitol.
Chairman Haas, distinguished members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity. My name is Dennis McNanny. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Bioscience Association. With me today is Adrian Poliak, CEO of one of the companies that's been very active in the BioPro program. Before I begin giving you my remarks, if I could answer the question that Senator Beyer proposed. The existing program that we have, which is unique in the country, there's no other organization like ours that has a BioPro workforce training program. Has been actively supported and have been very cooperative effort with Workforce Systems, Inc., our local workforce training board. But as was intimated by Senator Devlin, this is a different sort of program. It's almost where economic development meets workforce training. And so the advantage is that we have this very well-established program that we can apply to the problem. And like Senator Devlin, I would say this long-term, if it proves out to be a successful pilot, might reside within the workforce training budget in the future. But for the moment, we think it's a really good partnership. And even within this pilot, we'll be working very closely with the workforce training boards, sifting through all of the unemployed Oregonians to try to find those candidates that are going to be best suited to succeed with this augmented training. For those of you who don't know, I'm not going to take as much time as you might think. We have a fact sheet, which is available to you on the program, and then SAM Medical has prepared some testimony that will also be submitted today. The program goes back about 4 years. The BioPro program consists of 52 classes taught by over 30 instructors. They're half-day, full-day, and two-day training courses on very specific topics that are critical to bioscience companies. Those are regulatory in nature. They are, in many cases, project management in a bioscience environment. They sort of span the gamut. It's not what you would learn, for example, at a community college, which really puts us in a position to give this 2 weeks of immersion training to likely candidates. And those likely candidates, as was mentioned, might be software engineers. The hardest job to fill right now in Biotronic is software engineering. And some of the software engineers that would be qualified to work on the software you'd find in a defibrillator or a pacemaker is actually embedded software programmers, which, frankly, that part of the Oregon technical market hasn't come roaring back with the other areas of software. So we think with some support from the state, we can construct a program that will help transition those workers over. Without taking any more time, one of the things I'd like to do is introduce Adrian Poliak so that he can talk a little bit about his company and their experiences with the BioPro program and how that might segue over to this pilot program that we'd like to initiate.
Thank you, Dennis. Thank you, Chairman Haas, and the rest of you for allowing me to speak to you today. SAM Medical is a 28-year-old company. It was founded by an orthopedic surgeon and his wife on the Oregon coast in 1985.
Dennis, could you start off by with your ID?
Okay, oh. I apologize. So Adrian Poliak, president of SAM Medical Products, Wilsonville, Oregon. So as I was saying, SAM Medical is a 28-year-old company. We've been around for a long time. We originally started out with the SAM splint. This is this product right here that's used for fracture management. Fairly simple product that changed the way splinting was done. And more recently, we've developed a lot more products over the past 10 years for trauma as well, specifically for individuals out in the battlefield, paramedics who treat victims out in the city, battlefield. environment in the urban streets. This is a product called the SAM Junctional Tourniquet. It comes in a bag that I just pulled out of here. And this is an example of the type of product that we produce today. This is designed for high-level amputations as a result of an IED or an explosion, such as we saw at the Boston bombings. It comes around the waist. It applies pressure through these expandable targets to stop the blood flow over the inguinal artery. And that will stop the bleeding down to what's ever left of the leg or legs. This is truly a lifesaver. It's a product that's been on the market for 7 months. It has had tremendous acceptance by the U.S. Army, by militaries in Europe, and now beginning elsewhere. This product is produced entirely in Oregon. The only parts that are not produced in our factory are injection molded in Tigard. So this product is sourced in the U.S., very amendment compliant, and produced, sewn, and assembled in Wilsonville in our facility. This is an example of the kinds of products we make.
What does that sell for?
The cost of this is $350. Very expensive product. We hope in time with volume it'll come down. But it's just incredibly complex and expensive to put together. It looks simple, but it's quite complex. The wonderful story about this is that we used a design firm called Zeba Design in Portland, in the Pearl District, a very accomplished design group. It was the first time us as a small manufacturer could afford to do such a thing. It was a very interesting collaboration. We also worked closely with the military key opinion leaders back in D.C. and Texas, in South Carolina, North Carolina, to help us with design inputs so that this product came to market already well vetted out by those that have experience with this injury. So it was just a wonderful example of how new product development should and can occur, and we hope to continue that. The key part of why I'm saying this is that we have spent a lot of time and a lot of money bringing quality people on board. Not just on the engineering side or the chemistry side, but also in the marketing and sales aspects, sales sides. And to the extent we can, we obviously would like to hire people from this state. We've had to make a few out-of-state hires. For a company our size, we have 40 employees. We're just under $10 million in revenue. That's a very, very expensive proposition to do. We don't like to do that, and it really affects us financially to have to go seek somebody out and pay relocation expenses. This opportunity with SB 1527 would allow a company like SAM Medical to tap into talent that exists in other industries right here in our state without having to go seek folks elsewhere. And I can tell you, as an executive, I spend a lot of time, probably two, maybe three coffees or lunches a month, speaking to other folks, mid-management level folks, some executives who are looking for a transition from one field to another. And it is incredible how often they come to the bioscience sector. I know this is something Dennis deals with almost on a daily basis. And that's an indication of the health of the bioscience, biotechnology sector. But it also tells us that the transition from, let's say, high-tech or software to bioscience is quite substantial. That gap has to be bridged, and this program here that this bill will hopefully bridge that gap.
I have 2 points that I could add to that, I think, that might help you put some context around the bill. One is that we've taken to calling it an A-STEM program, and for us, applied STEM means taking someone who has great academic credentials and qualifications, but giving them the kind of industry training that really jumpstarts and accelerates their transition into an industry. Ours is fraught with technical terms and regulatory terms, and if you come in as a fluidics engineer without knowing any of those terms, it can be months and months and months before you get up and running. And when a company's weighing hire someone from out of state or mentoring someone through that 4 to 6 month period, I think it's an unnecessary compromise and impediment that we put our engineers through. The second thing, besides defining it as A-STEM, and the reason we chose A-STEM was I look at STEM investments, educational investments, as this broad portfolio. Some you have to wait a long time for it to work out. Others, like in this applied instance, you could see a return to the state that year. On top of the social implications of being able to keep someone in state, not having to sell their home. So I think for that reason alone, it helps give some context. The other, I suppose, relevant fact is that we still have a lot of engineering talent on the street right now. I think the numbers we see from the economy are very heartening, But there's some really chronically long-term employed people who are not in a position to go back and get retrained, get another degree. And it's really those targeted, those engineers we'd like to target mid-career. And a clarification, the reason the average wage we're targeting is $80,000 is because we're really targeting these mid-career folks. The average wage is much more around $60,000. But the nice thing about employing an engineer or a project manager is they have a multiplier effect. For every one of those, you're likely to hire two or three more people once that product line or that job begins to accrue benefits to the company.
Well, it's just one of those fascinating nuances of technology that you can be an engineer with several degrees and yet still be unemployed or lack the skills, you know, 20 years after. It's a little counterintuitive, but
it's in my area, it's I think it's counterintuitive because normally 10 years ago they would have moved to where their skills were more marketable. But given the immobility of the workforce right now, given that they're tied to mortgages and particularly at that point in your career, it provides a rock and a hard place situation.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, this is a question purely out of my ignorance. Because we're talking engineers, there's engineers and there's engineers. How broad of a spectrum are you looking at? I mean, mechanical engineers? Kind of the whole spectrum, is that what we're looking at?
Yeah, the Biotronics facility that was mentioned by Senator Devlin is almost completely automated. And I mean almost completely automated. So those jobs now stay in Oregon because we can employ engineers, mechanical engineers, robotics engineers to maintain that. So it's a different workforce, really, that we're dealing with.
Further questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Appreciate the time of the committee.
Good luck to you and moving forward.
Thanks.
Thank you. Hopefully we'll have less and less need for those triage.
That's the whole, yeah, exactly.
I drive safer with him in the car, I'll tell you. Just thinking about it.
I bet. Sean Gilliams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Sean Gilliams representing Oregon Workforce Partnership. I promise I didn't set Senator Beyer up with that question about the Workforce Investment Board. We are in support of the -1 amendments, which would require consultation or coordination with the local workforce investment boards. Obviously, I'll be back up here to talk about Senate Bill 1566 and the overhaul of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board and workforce design as well. That, Mr. Chair, happy to answer any questions.
Great. Questions? Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
Elaine Gainey. Elaine?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elaine Gainey on behalf of the Oregon AFL-CIO. I've got to tell you, this sounds like a great program, and from a policy perspective, there's nothing bad I could say about it. It seems fantastic. It seems like they're doing really wonderful work. I'm up here to just flag a couple of concerns that we have about the dollars. We've seen a trend in our economy in Oregon away from companies investing in their own workforces toward more and more companies in Oregon asking community colleges, asking the state, asking our workforce system to fund their training and their retraining programs. In some cases, that's warranted. Often these are companies who could be investing those dollars on their own. It sounds like the biosciences are investing a lot of their own money. There may be a need for some state dollars, but I just want to flag that concern and make sure that as we're looking at policies like this, we're looking at them with a keen eye toward what our state priorities are and where we should be spending our money. I believe that these folks have funds coming in from Business Oregon as well, and we just want to make sure that as we look at our workforce system, we're not relying more and more on state dollars at the expense of the other programs that the state needs to provide. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Good point. Solid point. Okay, no one else has signed up or invited to testify. This has a referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee, and we're in a work session.
Chair Hass, I move to adopt the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 1527, dated February 10, 2014.
Senator Knoll moves to adopt the -1 amendments. Any discussion? Any objections? The amendments are adopted.
Chair Hass, I move Senate Bill 1527 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the conference or the committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 1527 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Senate Bill 1527 as amended moves to the committee on Ways and Means. And we'll close that work session, and we will move directly to Senate Bill 1566. Open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1566. Administrator Donahue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Senate Bill 1566 declares state public policy to promote a coordinated provision of education, employment, and job training. It assigns new duties to the State Workforce Investment Board. It abolishes regional workforce committees. It declares an emergency effective on passage. And the committee has been asked to consider the Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 2 amendments include community colleges and public and private universities in the mandate. It also mandates that the governor appoint one member of the State Workforce Investment Board who is a representative of a local workforce investment board. Thank you.
Okay. And on Senate Bill 1566, we'll start with Agnes Balassa from the governor's office. And why don't you come up with your team, Lisa Nissenfield and Karen Humelbaum.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, I'm Agnes Balassa, the governor's workforce advisor, the governor's policy advisor for workforce, and I'm here today to testify on Senate Bill 1566, which relates to the Oregon State Workforce Investment Board. I brought Lisa Nissenfeld with the Employment Department with me and Karen Hummelbaugh from Community Colleges and Workforce Development. In order to keep our comments concise and recognizing your time, I'll do most of the comments, but Lisa and Karen are here and to answer any additional technical questions you may have and to be able to talk about the effects on their agencies in particular if you are interested in that. And so I'd like to also call your attention to the fact that we've had a couple of letters of support submitted, which we've just provided to committee staff as well for you. Since 1998, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board has been charged with providing strategic direction and overseeing the programs and services that help Oregonians turn their talents and to gainful employment. Specifically, these programs help the unemployed and underemployed become employed and progress along career pathways, help businesses find qualified employees in order to support and grow their companies, and help assure that the supply of skilled workers is aligned with the demand of current companies and future economic development. Over the last several years, numerous reports and studies, including at least one that was commissioned by the legislature under House Bill 4141 in a previous session, have identified the fact that the fragmented nature of the workforce system is a primary challenge to the efficient and effective delivery of services to the system's primary customers, job seekers, and businesses. The system consists mostly of federally funded programs administered primarily through three agencies, that create a network and patchwork of approaches to try to help certain populations be able to get back to employment, help general population access services, assure that skills are translated into actual employability at the end of the day. A consistent theme of the analysis has been the need for the State Workforce Investment Board to take a stronger role in creating public accountability and transparency for this fragmented system and aligning the programs and services in the system to assure that as many of Oregon's citizens and businesses as possible have the opportunity to achieve their goal. And so SB 1566 was designed to address these challenges in several ways. First, it clarifies the Oregon Workforce Investment Board's relationship to the Employment Department. Currently, the board has only oversight, and fairly limited oversight at that, over the Workforce Investment Act Title I-B program, which is administered at the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. Yet about a third of the resources in the system and about a third of the programs in the system are administered by the Oregon Employment Department, which does not receive similar transparency and oversight through the board. And so SB 1566 places these programs together under the oversight of the board, which means that there's public commentary on strategic plans, on outcomes, on goals, on the ability to implement programs. It also provides greater system accountability by providing the board with the authority to approve local strategic plans, the primary vehicle by which the Oregon State Workforce Board translates expectations for outcomes and strategies to serve people is through its strategic plan. That plan then is translated then at the local level into local strategic plans. By giving the board the ability to approve those plans, you now have a line of accountability. The board can hold not only the local workforce boards, but also the state agencies that deliver the services under that plan accountable. Again, increasing in transparency and making sure that everybody is looking towards the same set of outcomes, pulling together and delivering on what they've promised when they signed off on a local plan. It provides greater workforce system accountability by allowing OWIP to enter into performance compacts as well with both local boards and state agencies so that everybody is clear about the performance goals that they have committed to and have a mechanism for reporting on those regularly. It cleans up some policy language that's been around since before 1998 that we've been needing to clean up for a long time. And it also eliminates the regional workforce boards from statute, which has created longstanding confusion about the roles and responsibilities, local boards, regional boards, some were both. It just clears all of that up. We have letters of support from two entities that I just want to point out to you really quickly. Jessica Gomez is one of the chairs of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and she states in her letter, one of the significant challenges in this conversation has been that the OWIB faces enormous responsibility without authority to hold anyone accountable to outcomes. The OWIB is ready, willing, and able to take on a new expanded role that will ensure greater transparency and public accountability for workforce programs. And in a letter from the Oregon Workforce Partnership, the Association of Local Workforce Boards, they comment that this is the first but significant legislative step needed in order to address inefficiencies at the state level. We look forward to working with the governor's office and other stakeholders to develop ways that will make a fragmented workforce system more efficient. Ultimately, we want to focus on serving our customers rather than navigating a fragmented system. Senate Bill 1566 is an important phase in achieving that. Finally, I'd just like to close by saying that the governor's choice to use one of the five bills afforded to him in this session to focus on this issue shows a strong commitment to a larger, longer-term conversation about system alignment that starts just with this one piece around governance. The bill with the -2 amendments, which were primarily offered by community colleges and local workforce investment boards that actually strengthen the bill, we believe, establishes the transparency and accountability that will become the foundation for next phases and allow us to actually track on how changes make a difference for future Oregonians, be able to do more evidence-based planning in the future, be able to look across systems as each one of these systems has had reduced resources to assure that we actually have a full web of services as opposed to a fractured system of programs. So with that, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today and to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you. Lisa and Karen, do you have testimony or are you here for technical support? Okay. The effect of the amendment, Agnes, is what? You refer to it, but
yes, Chair Hass and members of the committee. The amendments came about in a couple of ways. One was to clear up a little bit of technical language that once we looked at the drafting of the bill, we realized that we used the words in a number of different ways. And so some of them are just technical pieces to make sure we've got the right language in there. The additional amendments focus on clarifying what is the strategic plan. Since the strategic plan is the primary accountability vehicle and was not clearly defined in a way that indicated that in previous versions. We added a piece to clarify that. It clarifies what we mean by workforce programs, better definition there, what we mean by workforce systems, some better definition. So some things that as people who had a stake in the bill were interested in making sure that if we're going to do this, we cover all the pieces that need to be addressed. There's also an addition of to bring on a member of the local workforce boards as a member of the state workforce board, as well as a piece on the clarification about the role of labor market information to better align demand with supply in the workforce strategic planning. I think I covered all of them.
Well, yes, you adopted if I 15 of 16 recommendations that are in this bill. I hate to make you do this, but can you talk about the one that didn't make the cut and why it was controversial, just to
Absolutely.
Clear the air?
The Senator has members of the committee. Following the report that was developed in response to House Bill 4141, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board undertook two steps. One, it refined its strategic plan, finalized the strategic plan, and two, it asked for the system to look at how to create some of the efficiencies and how to address some of the issues that were brought up in that report. Over the last year, a consultant has been brought on, as well as a lot of research has been done, that resulted in a set of 15 recommendations to improve alignment, increase transparency, and bring resources together along a common vision and goals. Most of those recommendations had to do with clarifying outcomes, clarifying the role of the State Workforce Board, setting up some incentives to be able to support promising practices, creating a system for documenting promising practices. The board adopted all the recommendations and asked that one have continued review. And the piece that had continued review is around where the proper home for the Workforce Investment Act Title I-B funds is. The original proposal had been to move those over to the Employment Department. We are continuing to look at the challenges and opportunities with making that happen. But the board wanted some more timeline on that, feeling that if we could get these pieces in place in the meanwhile, it would lay the groundwork for that conversation to happen from a foundation of transparency and accountability as opposed to a shortened timeline to move some things quickly forward. So.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Agnes, the so we have a state workforce strategic plan.
Yes, sir.
But the money goes through to the local areas.
Yes, sir.
And they independently develop local plans. So how do you align that to meet statewide needs versus local or regional needs?
Senator Beyer, Chair Hass, members of the committee, in some ways, this is not all that different from what we do in the education world through compacts, in that there is state funding that goes to local school districts through their boards in order to achieve certain goals. The local plan really is the key for creating the alignment. The state plan creates the high-level set of, identifies the high-level set of outcomes we are trying to achieve, identify some strategies to create greater alignment and coordination, and then the locals translate that through their local plan and interpret that. One of the differences in the workforce system is that some of these programs are delivered locally through the money that flows through local boards. Some of these services are delivered through staff at large state agencies like the Employment Department, like Department of Human Services. And so the local plan is the way that everybody comes together and commits to what they will do to implement the statewide strategic goals. If we have compacts in place, that will be a second tool that will allow us to identify how each of these programs and funding streams play into a set of outcomes that we're all trying to achieve. But it's a messy system. It is designed across multiple acts of Congress, multiple federal agencies, and numerous state agencies as well. So this is our way of trying to align it all together and bring it together.
No, it is messy. I hope this meets the mission of clarifying it, because when I look, we just have a little summary here, and I see OWIB, Workforce Development Strategic Plan, Workforce System Redesign Work Group, Local Force Investment Boards, PFM, Workforce System Redesign, OWIB. It's just, and that's in like two sentences. And so I really hope we can clarify that, Senator Bonner.
You know, I guess we're in an opportunity area, and I'm glad to see the HEC referenced here, because I think that's the legislature's an attempt to try and get the education things put together. There's really nothing new here. I mean, we've been having state and local boards since the 1960s in this area. The feds have changed the name of the programs, but the only significant thing they've done over 40 years is they've reduced the money by about 70%. So I wish you luck with this.
Chair Haas and Senator Beyer, I think one thing that's become very clear to us is as the resources have reduced, we no longer are in a position where we can look at these as individual separate programs. The commitment we have to program versus the commitment to outcomes has been one of our greatest challenges over the last several years, as each program is forced into its corner trying to preserve what it can provide. This is really intended to take a look across systems to see what we can do differently. And in terms of the coordination with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, we have formed we're in the process of forming a task force between the OWIB and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to identify some of the places of overlap and assure that they're properly assigned or addressed together when necessary. Because clearly, a workforce system that serves the unemployed and underemployed cannot be effective without the contributions and the excellence of an education system that prepares people for new jobs, better jobs, and moves them and helps them move along. And so we're trying to figure out exactly how to manage those things between these two boards, one of which has a laser-like focus on unemployed, underemployed, current workers, people who are out of the educational pipeline, and another that's very much about moving people through an educational pipeline and bringing them back in if necessary. So there's a lot of space for commonality that we're going to have to sort through in the next few months and years. Thank you very much.
Andrea Henderson.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. And with the Dash 2 amendments on this bill, the Oregon Community College Association has moved from opposing the bill to a neutral position on the bill. So let me talk a little bit about some of our concerns and where we see the bill going from this point. As you probably know, a large part of the community college mission is to deliver part of the workforce system in Oregon. The career technical education, our support to businesses, the many different training programs we have that get people trained for a job. So community colleges have been very concerned about this bill and what might happen. I'd like to thank the governor's office for the work over the last couple of weeks to try to get the language in this bill to a place where we can be neutral on the bill and really appreciate the conversation and the amendments that explicitly include the community colleges and post-secondary education in part of the workforce system. That being said, there still is a lot of work that needs to be done on this issue. Certainly, as Agnes mentioned, there is an upcoming task force that will look at the relationship between the HEC and the OWIB, and how are those conversations where there's overlap going to occur, and how will that really continuity in the programs happen at the state level. This is an issue that's been very concerning for community colleges. Traditionally, we've been in with the Workforce Development Department as part of the Community College Department and have enjoyed that close connection with both community colleges and the workforce system. As we move over to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission this coming July, we want to make sure that there's still that clear connection to the workforce conversation, because that is a large part of our mission. And as we look at the Middle 40, which really are the major place for community colleges to play in Oregon, we want to make sure that that conversation is deeply embedded in what our employers need, and that the work through the Workforce Board, that acknowledgement of what employers need is directly connected to the work at HEC and to the work that community colleges are doing, so that we're all moving together in concert. There was conversation a little bit about the Title I-B money and where that might end up. From the community college perspective, we certainly like having it in with the Community College and Workforce Development Department. We think there's a good connection there, and we look forward to a very open conversation about what it might look like in the future. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions? I think you're exactly right that there has to be a very solid everybody on the same page, working in concert and strong, positive relationships. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's got to be a baseline. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Sean Jillians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, again, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Workforce Partnership, which is a coalition of the local workforce investment boards in our state. I'd also like to express my gratitude to the governor's office for working with us on potential amendments. We got them late last night. I know it's been a long process getting them here, and I think we might have a little bit of tweaking left to do as far as just clarifying a few things, nothing sweeping in the amendments. Likewise, we're very supportive and looking forward to the task force that's going to be put together by the governor to hopefully bring back a little more robust plan next session to you all. Senator Beyer will be familiar. The original bill as proposed was a little more sweeping and did a little more streamlining at the state level, and I know that caused consternation amongst our colleagues and partners in the workforce system. So we look forward to continuing that conversation in the interim and coming back to you with an additional proposal in 2015. Primarily support the Dash 2 amendments, although we would like to see a little clarifying language, Mr. Chair. With that, happy to answer any questions.
Are you working on or proposing another amendment for this bill?
Mr. Chair, I was going to work off of the Dash 2s and just insert a few items so that it would be clean and easy for legislative council. We had in some of the definitions as far as local plans and the state strategic plan, just a little wordsmithing to do in there. And so that's all we were looking for in those amendments, Mr. Chair.
All right. Well, yeah, Thursday is the last day, as you know, so this will all be done by Thursday.
I anticipate, Mr. Chair, be done this afternoon. If you really wanted to move the bill today, we could work on the House side as well to get additional amendments. I don't know if you want to have it come back for concurrence, but.
No, we can wait till Thursday. It will be a hairy day on Thursday. Hope we don't lose it in the neck. No, we won't. Okay. Thanks.
My faith is in your hands, Mr. Chair.
All right, thanks. I'm going to close the work session and public hearing on Senate Bill 1566.
Do you want to carry that work session
and, over? And I will carry Senate Bill 1566 over until Thursday. I was going to make an announcement on the air.
Yeah.
And so let me open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1509, better known as the Mascot Bill. Summary, Administrator Donovan.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1509 permits school district boards to enter into a written agreement with federally recognized Native American tribes in Oregon to identify an acceptable name, symbol, or image of mascots that represent or is associated with a Native American tribe, to identify behavior and behavioral expectations at athletic events, and to identify required training on cultural diversity. It declares an emergency effective on passage. The committee has been asked to consider the Dash 1 amendments, which require that any agreement be entered into before July 1st of 2017. The committee considered this measure last session, or a similar measure, last session, Senate Bill 215, and Governor Kitzhaber exercised his Article 5 powers and vetoed that measure.
Okay, thank you. We have Representative Springer and our very own Senator Cruz. Would you like to take it from here or get on the table?
I can do that.
Okay.
May I also bring somebody that's going to be testifying with me?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. I'll be very brief. This is basically the same bill that we had a year ago that the governor vetoed. And what we were led to understand, and I think justifiably so, that if we sent the same bill back to the governor, he would have the same reaction to it. So in an attempt to try to do a modification, what we looked at was the fact that the bill basically said if there was an agreement that everything would be good between a school and a tribe, but it was an incredibly open-ended thing. And So we looked at the decision that had been made by the State Board of Education that basically gave school districts until 2017 to make adjustments or they would jeopardize losing state funds. And so we thought, well, that date's already been set there. So what the amendment basically does is say that if by that date that has been set by the state board, a school district and a tribe has reached an agreement, that that agreement will stand and they can maintain status quo. If they haven't, then that ruling takes effect and they would have to make the change. And so it basically what we're attempting to do is put a finite time frame on this so that it potentially doesn't go out in time forever and ever. And so we figured that aligning with the decision by the state board would accomplish that. But I will have to say, Mr. Chair, I think in virtually all cases, those agreements should be relatively easy to come by because in most cases the work's already been done. So we don't think we're tasking either the local tribes or the school districts with a great deal of work. Basically what we're asking them to do is put down in a document that the agreement, you know, in the case of, for example, between the Cow Creek Tribe and the Roseburg School Districts, we're asking them to put down what they've already agreed to and that would suffice. So it's really no more complicated than that, and I'm hoping to have basically the same outcome in the legislature that we had last year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sherry Springer, State Representative, House District 17 from SIO. And I think the good senator here did a great job of teeing up this bill and talking about some of the particulars. And this is not a new issue to any of us. We've been talking about this now for about 2 years, at least I have, at the state board level. So a couple things that I want to highlight for you and just remind us all of is this bill is... goes back to one of the foundational relationships the state has had for many years, and it's a government-to-government relationship, the tribes and the government. And I think that's a good relationship. I think that has worked well. I have not talked to a tribal member that says that's not worked. This bill, to my understanding, and certainly I could be wrong, but I've not found an instance where this is one of the first, if not the only time, we are superseding that relationship and not allowing the tribes to speak for themselves, and another state organization, State Board of Education, coming in and saying this is what we feel is best. And I think that it's important we come back to the original idea, which is this is a respectful relationship, government to government. This bill does nothing to overturn that rule, that administrative rule. It allows additional language that says if, based on that government-to-government relationship, an agreement is met, then a waiver shall be granted in that very specific case. If there isn't an agreement that has been met, then certainly there isn't a trip to the State Board of Education worth taking because there is no agreement. And the administrative rule stands. And I think the fundamental piece to that is beyond a history of government-to-government relationships, and I have to applaud our governor for being the one that has championed this for years, and that is that government-to-government relationship has been a very firm foundation for building authentic relationships. Let me give you a for instance. So in Lebanon, which is one of the towns in the district I represent, have close ties there, Lebanon Warriors. Because of the state rule, they can always be Lebanon Warriors, because warrior is not a name exclusive to a Native American tribe. So they can always be Lebanon Warriors. And when they recently put in the new football field and the track, which is a gorgeous, gorgeous facility, they put an L and a W, a red and blue L and W in the middle of the field. In the gymnasium, they have a warrior emblem, a Native American emblem in the gym floor that's been there for years. So because of the ban, they will still, if they choose, to be Lebanon Warriors. And they will go through, and any imagery that's Native American, they'll get rid of, and then they'll move on. And that will be the end of the story. If they were able to take advantage of this, the language in this bill, They would maybe, certainly it could still be the Lebanon Warriors, but now, whether they keep imagery, some imagery or not, they begin building a relationship with the Kalapuya tribe. And they start learning. And instead of learning about the Cherokee and the Navajo, which there's great value in that, those aren't Oregon tribes. That's what I learned about in Oregon schools. And so this provides that opportunity to go farther than you can't do this or you lose money. And they continue to be the Lebanon Warriors. And wouldn't it be a great thing a year or two down the road when there's homecoming or one of the great events that we love and we have all these pieces that we've done and they're very important, whether it be a bonfire or whatever. Now we have a ceremony that's authentic because the Native American tribe in that area has come together and we've learned something. And we have an appreciation for a culture different than ours. And frankly, and for good or bad, I have very little diversity in my house district. Very little. This is an opportunity to have real diversity, real relationship, and to move forward in a healthy way other than we can't. So we're still 11 Warriors and we didn't learn anything. Now, you can say and argue, and I agree with this, nothing's preventing that today. How many good ideas do we talk about in this body that legislators bring? We should be doing this in schools. And how many times do we say there are so many demands, there's so many tough things to do, and we pull them back off the table? This is an opportunity that affords and creates that opportunity if school districts and if local tribes want to. And if they don't want to, that's okay. The rule stands. Just one or two last points here. The amendment here, one of the things I like about the amendment, frankly, is it just seems to kind of seal this issue up. It clarifies language. It moves us forward. It kind of puts this issue to rest for those districts, for all districts, but certainly for those districts that want to move forward and try to strike an agreement and for those districts that don't. And it just seems to be, to me, a very common sense way to say this issue's been settled. And keep in mind, we're talking about 16 schools in this state. You'll hear a lot of testimony, I'm sure, about research. I've seen some of the pictures in that research. I've gone through a ton of it. And what I'm seeing in that research is offensive pictures to me. And so if there's offensive pictures, depictions, emblems that are being used in schools, they need to be removed. I've not seen instances of that in this state recently. It has occurred. I mean, we have Roseburg is a great example of years ago saying, government-to-government relationship, we need to come together and solve this. And guess what? Nobody told them to do it. They did it, and it worked, and they've moved forward. And they have, from what I understand, a much better relationship now because they sat down and they got to know each other. The last point, I just want to be very clear on this. When I spoke to the governor on the phone about 2 days before he vetoed this bill in August, and discussing the particulars of it, I gave him my word and my commitment at that time, and it stands today. And that is, like I said, we have about 15, 16 schools that we're talking about in the state of Oregon. And I told him at that time, I said, if you will simply not veto the bill and the bill will pass, you have my commitment that I will visit each one of these schools across the state this year and hopefully get in front of the board, but preferably get in front of the community and relay the message to these other communities that I have been relaying to my community, which is very simple. This is not a mechanism to keep an emblem on a football jersey. This is an opportunity to create real relationships, and it is about two people, two parties sitting down at a table saying, what can we do here that's good and right for all of us and move forward, and not about what do I have to do to get by? Because I really want districts to understand this isn't about gym floors, not about jerseys, not about trophy cases. It is about real diversity in mostly our rural communities and an opportunity to learn from another culture and to have that real and authentic relationship. And certainly I'm willing to answer any questions that you have, and I think you have one more person here to speak.
I'm Austin Springer. I come from a small town that will be affected because of this. Lebanon has the Native American as its mascot, and without this bill, we will lose that. And we'll lose pretty much any connection we'll have with our local native tribe. If I go through my school and I ask everyone what our local tribe is, I can think of maybe 10 people that can tell us that. and that's the Kalapuya tribe. So far, I've learned more about the local tribes around us outside of my school than in it. With this, we can bring the different tribes and the schools together and put something in it that we can learn more about different tribes around us, and not just the big ones everyone learns about growing up, but we can learn what it was like with the tribes locally for us.
Mr. Chair, if I could, because Representative Springer brought up the government-to-government relationship, and I was here serving in the House when Governor Kitzhaber was governor first phase, and that was probably one of the hallmarks of his administration then, was the development of that government-to-government relationship. And we basically set a standard, I think, for the rest of the country in that. But the way that has evolved over time, because we started out with government-to-government, that being the tribal government and state government, but that has evolved down to the local level virtually everywhere at this point in time, to where the tribes have relationships at the county level, at the city level, at the school level. And one of my favorite examples is back in, it's been a while ago, when we were in Douglas County exploring the concept of bringing a Boys and Girls Club to Douglas County, which we have done. And one of the reasons we were able to do that was the relationship we had developed at the county level with the Cow Creek Tribe and their willingness to get involved in that sort of enterprise. And without them, we could have never pulled it off. And you know, it's just, I think we can find all over the state examples of how the government-to-government relationship at all levels of government with the tribes in the state of Oregon has done nothing but enhance the activities that we have undertaken in this state. And I agree with Representative Springer that's the level these decisions should be made, not by some state-level board. And so that's why we're doing this. And I think at the end of the day, by allowing this local decision to take place and them to develop what is acceptable to the school and to the tribe is going to benefit us all.
Questions? Okay, thank you all. Senator Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure. So when we talk about our government-to-government relationships, we're really talking about the federally recognized tribes.
Yes. Yes.
So it would have to be one of those that we make our agreement with. Is that correct?
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, Senator Roman, we understand that there are members of other tribes in Oregon, but quite honestly, we can get really splintered if we, you know, you have to have a point of contact. The federally recognized tribes in the state of Oregon are the tribes that have been here, and they have gone through, they have jumped through the hoops to actually become a federally recognized tribe. And I think that's significant and important. And historically, as we have developed these relationships from the perspective of the state of Oregon, those are the people we have been developing the relationships with. And those are the relationships that are transferring down to the local government levels.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good job, Justin. Okay, we're going to go through a list here. I'm going to start off with Siadum Edmo. Is John Gossett here?
John Dossett is en route. It may be advantageous for us to go when he arrives. He was in that traffic accident, but he's on his way. He was behind it. Okay. Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Siadum Edmo. I'm Shoshone Bannock, Nez Perce in Yakima, and I'm here as the Vice President of the Oregon Indian Education Association and a member of the staff of Lewis and Clark Graduate School of Education. You know, this bill, 1509, is essentially the same bill that we saw introduced last session. And for OIEA, there were some fundamental things that were at issue, that we had issue with regarding the bill. And Representative Springer is correct in part when she contends that this bill is about a government-to-government relationship. It is in part about a government-to-government relationship. At issue here are both group and individual rights. So sovereign tribal cultural property rights and human civil rights and the rights of Native students that protect them from discrimination in public schools. So we argue that these human and civil rights cannot be waived at the local level. You cannot simply create an agreement to waive somebody's rights when they have no party or no say in what's going on around them. As you know, in Oregon, we have, according to the Department of Education, about 9,500 American Indian Alaska Native students who identify as American Indian Alaska Native in our public schools. Not all of these students are from tribes in Oregon. And our rights, my right as a mom, my children's rights cannot be waived by creating an agreement with a local tribe. If this issue involved high schools using a specific tribal name, having secured the tribe's explicit permission, there may be a path forged that would respect the rights of individuals and tribes. However, that does not seem to be the path that our lawmakers here have proposed. What is at issue is exposing individual Native students to mascotting, targeting, and bullying for sport, recreation, and entertainment. And such action is neither dignified nor viewed as an honor by Native people. Instead, we contend that such legislation has its roots in race-based discrimination and a violation of human and civil rights of tribal citizens. Moreover, tribes overwhelmingly across the United States have called for an end to the practice of race-based imagery and sports. And finally, I'd like to just share some historical photos with the committee, if I may. So you heard a little bit about the research, and I would ask that each of you spend some time with some of the research. There were over 50 sociological and psychological reports that were submitted to the State Board of Education when they first undertook this issue. It wasn't a small task. However, each one of those studies supported a ban of the use of Indian mascots in schools. Not one said it was something that was good for students, it was positive for students. These photos were photos taken from my father's yearbook. He grew up in the Dalles. We're very much Oregonians. He grew up at Celilo Falls, one of the oldest settlements. Just because we're not federally recognized doesn't mean we're less Oregonian than any other person. And these mascots were created during this time. The majority of Indian mascots that are used in Oregon schools were created during a time of racial hatred. There were signs in their community that said no dogs or Indians allowed. There were laws against Native folks being able to go and eat in restaurants. And these mascots are remnants of that legacy. And I ask you to consider, as you consider this bill, whether you want to enshrine into public policy this legacy. I thank you for your time, and I'll answer any questions.
Appreciate you coming forward, given your background and your expertise in this area. One question I had that did come up earlier was the word warrior,
mm-hmm.
which is allowed under the board. Can you speak to that and how you think that should play out? Well, I think we did have testimony last year from a Marine who said, "Don't." I'm a warrior,
mm-hmm.
Native American.
Mm-hmm. We support the way the law is currently written. The Oregon Administrative Rule is currently written, which indicates the use of the term warrior not in association with American Indian symbol or image.
You and I spoke, and you used the phrase namesake
mm-hmm.
provision. And I think you use that in terms of what the NCAA had done. Can you explain how that would work and why that may be a more preferable alternative?
Correct. Courts have upheld tribes' rights to their own individual image and name. So in trademark court, for example, when the Navajo Nation sued Urban Outfitters over the term, over the name of their tribe, the name Navajo, and that has been upheld in court. So tribes have been found and supported in their right to their own name and their own image. But speaking collectively, I mean, I think the organization that speaks the loudest on behalf of, or the most representative on behalf of most American Indian, Alaska Native people and tribes is the National Congress of American Indians. Now, John Dossett, their general counsel, is en route here to Salem right now, and he can explain, but just a quick overview of who NCAI is. The National Congress of American Indians is the largest advocacy organization for tribes nationwide. They represent about 250 to 260, depending on the membership at the time, of tribes in the United States. And that number is representative of about 75% of the American Indian Alaska Native population in the United States. So their elected leaders are the elected leaders of the majority of tribal people in the United States. They have unanimously called for the ending of the use of Indian imagery in sports. And I think that voice is, you know, while we do have some things that I think can be worked at the local level, they are by and large the organization that that represents the most tribes and tribal people in the United States.
So how would that work then?
Mm-hmm.
Like with the Florida, the Seminole.
Correct.
How is there a place to go here in Oregon? The same kind of dynamic?
I think so. I mean, I think there probably is an opportunity to not only support the sovereignty of individual tribes to represent themselves through the use of their name and their own image, but it's not through a general loophole that refers to a whole race of people. That's not the way to go.
Further questions? Yeah. For Sierra?
Cruz. I'm just curious, the pictures you brought us are irrelevant. They were 60 years ago. Why didn't you bring us some pictures from a current yearbook to see how it's being depicted now?
I don't think history is irrelevant.
It's irrelevant as to what we're doing now. And the example I use is in the case of Roseburg, where they have totally changed everything, and the only depiction now is a feather. And so to look at something that was in a yearbook back in the 50s is totally irrelevant compared to what is happening now.
If you read the psychological studies, and I hope you actually do, you'll find that the findings of Dr. Stephanie Freiberg and the other psychologists and sociologists who have looked into this issue and done studies about this issue, you'll find that the psychological effects of, for example, a Chief Wahoo or a Pocahontas as compared to a Haskell Indian Nation's logo or what folks might call a more respectful logo are pretty much the same. Scientifically, there's no difference in the psychological effect, and they've been proven to produce a lower, students have a lower self-concept when being exposed to those symbols and images. So we're talking about a legacy of racism and objectification. And I never think that history is irrelevant when we're talking about that. These are remnants. What we have today, what Roseburg has today, what Lebanon has today, is part of that legacy and story. And we can't separate the birth and incubation of these symbols from what is happening now.
Mr. Cruz. Who paid for the psychological study?
I
would be interested in finding that out. The one thing I know about psychology and a lot of studies like this is the conclusions usually align with who paid the bill on it. So if you could find that information, I would like to have that.
I'd like to see other studies that maybe support the opposition, but there aren't any.
Senator Knope.
I'm Irish.
Mm-hmm.
Notre Dame has the Fighting Irish. They have a leprechaun as their mascot. Am I being discriminated against?
I think you can answer that question.
Either you are or you aren't. I mean, if we're going to leave it up to the individual to decide whether or not they're being discriminated against, then it isn't discrimination. If it's a class discrimination, then in fact it would be discrimination. But just because if an individual decides that they're being discriminated against because someone said something and the entire class isn't offended, but one person or a group of people is, or a minority in that class, to me that doesn't rise to a level of discrimination. Offense maybe, but not discrimination.
How do you get that stuff?
Senator Rowe.
So one of my concerns is the Siletz tribe, which is in my district, has their own charter school, and they have a symbol, because they are the players as well. It is Native American. Under the current board decision, they would have to change that image, which I think is really counterproductive to exactly what you're saying with respect to that tribe and that group of people. So I'm frustrated that we can't find a solution that allows the appropriate, because I do believe that there are appropriate uses of images and others, and I have family members who are tribal members, so I understand the concern. And I was a high school principal. I was always trying to figure out how do we get the disparity that currently exists between success in our schools with Native American tribal children, and I've worked with two tribes in our community to try to figure out how do we do that. So I recognize the issue, I recognize the problem and some of the symptoms of it, but sometimes when trying to come back and develop that pride in self, you have to be able to do some things, and I think this the current board does not take into consideration that when it comes to some of our local tribes. So that's just a, and I don't know how would you respond to what I could do with my Celeste. I mean, I think maybe, that's why I was listening carefully to the comment about the NCAA rules or whatever it is. Right now the rule is pretty hard and fast. There's just pretty much no way to do it. And I am not sure that that's the best solution. Any comments?
Yeah, Senator Haas, Senator Roblin. Let me first share a little bit about some of the research. I mean, whether or not somebody is offended by something, I think whether students are offended, whether their parents are offended, I think matters less than what the research tells us the effect on the student is. And the effect on the students in the classroom, the self-effect, is that they feel worse about who they are, they feel less able to become a future positive person, a future self. And I brought copies of Dr. Freiberg's. She has a summary of the research that she's done. And then Mr. Dossett can testify later as to NCAI's report. But I do think that there is a way, if the current bill stays, to find a compromise so that a specific tribe who has control over their specific name can work with a community to represent them and their image. What I don't think can happen is a tribe making a negotiation to generalize an entire race of folks, to represent make a deal on behalf of all Indian people. I mean, within the Portland Public Schools School District and the Salem School District, you have over 150 tribes represented within those student bodies. And to just waive all of their rights to a public education that is free of discrimination. I mean, think about the opposing teams in this case. I think about the cheerleaders who have to walk down the halls and see, you know, even if it's as mundane as beat the Indians, we know, those of us who have been to Oregon schools, we know what happens, that the conversation quickly digresses from beat the Indians to one about racial slurs and talking about casinos and misrepresentation of what tribal sovereignty is. Every single news article about this issue quickly digresses into attacks on us as Indian people. And that's the kind of environment we're creating in our schools when we continue to sit by and let these mascots go. Again, it could, you know, one person could fall on either side of the issue, but the research behind this doesn't tell it, regardless of the opinion of the person who is taking the survey, the research showed over and over and over again, even at schools that were majority Native folks who supported the use of Indian mascots, they showed a negative self-effect on them, on the actual Native person. So it's not about opinion, and I would challenge each of you to read the research. Look beyond people saying this is an offensive thing and it's racist. Look beyond that and look at the research into the effect on students and race relations.
Further questions? Seattle, thank you.
Thanks.
All right. I want to politely ask the rest of you when you come forward to be as brief as possible. We're getting into a little bit of a time crunch, so I will call up Justin Martin. And your team.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin. I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand, where I'm also the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member. With me today is our tribal chair, Ren Lino. I've been proud to work alongside of Ren for the last 17 years, ever since he jump-started my 72 Monte Carlo on my very first day of work in the parking lot when I left the lights on. So we've been very proud of some of the accomplishments that we have been able to make over that time. I will be very brief. You have our testimony in front of you today. But from the onset of Governor Attia and the creation of the Commission on Indian Services to Governor Kitzhaber and his executive order on the government-to-government process, and then the Oregon Senate putting that into statute in 2001, making the government-to-government process part of our daily lives here in the state, to the deletion of squaw language with Oregon geographic board names, to dealing with illegally held archaeological objects, to making tribal police officers the same in the eyes of the law for better public safety for our citizens, and then finally passing funding for an Indian education specialist. We've been able to do really good things, and you've all been part of that. We're all very thankful for that. What we are asking in this bill is not to change the way we do things or to change the Board of Education's rule on dealing with tribal mascots. What we are asking for is the opportunity to sit down and work on agreements with our communities and those school districts in which we live and operate every day. We're asking for the trust of every tribal member in Oregon, whether they're an Oregon federally recognized tribal member or not. But we're asking them to trust in us when we go sit down and try to deem what's culturally appropriate with that school district. We want to make sure that those school districts have a sounding board. We want to make sure our membership has a sounding board. And if any tribal person wants to contact our tribal government, we will also make sure that their voice is heard in this. But the reality is, we would like to see a little bit of trust as we move forward on this agreement process, because we've done such good work. We also want to turn the corner on this. We want to quit rehashing this argument. Frankly, it's an old argument, and we want to move forward. We're not denying that people have been offended in the past. We ourselves have faced that scrutiny for years and years and years. We want to turn that corner and start educating those communities. We want to educate those school districts as to who we are, why Oregon tribes are such an integral part of the fabric of daily life here in Oregon, what we mean to this community, what we mean to the state, and what we mean to that country. We're proud to be members of the National Congress of American Indians, which you are going to hear testimony from here in a bit. We are not aware of their national position. We are not aware that they were going to be here testifying. Again, we would ask them as members, and I know Celeste, who will be testifying today, are also members of the National Congress. We would ask them to have a little faith in us. When the Seminoles negotiated their agreement with Florida State University, I, as a tribal person, had faith in the fact that they would sit down and do the right thing for their people and the right thing for that community and the right thing for that school. So all we ask today is to revisit this bill, which passed last session, also passed the House and made its way to the governor's office. We've been working with the governor. We met with their staff today in looking at other potential compromises, and we look forward to your support of this Senate bill today, and glad to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think you're good to go.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chairman Haas, committee members, and members of Senate Education and Workforce Development Committee. My name is Ren Lino, and I am the tribal chairman and chairman of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. I am here today in support of SB 215-1, 1509. My lobbyist gave me the wrong stuff. As a sovereign nation, the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde has worked diligently to build a positive government-to-government relationship across all levels of government. We have done so on federal, state, and local levels, including with our local school districts. High school mascots are supposed to be inspirational. High schools do not adopt derogatory figures or slogans. They adopt admirable and inspirational figures. They ban names, Indians, Braves, Warriors, and Chiefs are inspirational Native images, and we do not view their use as derogatory. The Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, along with Oregon tribes, prefer a solution that it would allow schools to keep their Native mascots if they're collaborative with the representative tribe on positive portrayals of integral cultural studies to combat stereotypes. That being said, we are disturbed by the State Board of Education's apparent disregard for sovereignty and their passivity when it comes to ending racism against Oregon Native people and mandating that schools in Oregon teach our history. The Grand Ronde has a long-standing request into the State Department of Education to fund an Indian education specialist, which I believe was filled, and I think that was a great step forward. We are encouraged this legislation session that this might finally get done, and it was accomplished. There are 9 federally recognized Indian tribes in Oregon. The history of our people who have lived in Oregon since time immemorial covers the breadth of the state and neither ignored or briefly mentioned in our schools. Our Oregon students learn more about the Sioux and Apaches than they do about the Umpqua, Molalla, Rogue, and Kalapuya, and Chasa. And that's no disrespect to any other tribe, but this is the Northwest. This is Oregon. They should be learning about Oregon tribes. Why are our children going to school and teaching their teachers about our history? Rather than handling down an unfunded mandate on mascots, the State Board of Education should work towards a reduction or elimination of racism towards Oregon Native people and include Oregon tribes in its history books. And I'm very proud at this point to say we have had an accomplishment since we testified the last time. We have actually come forward with a fourth grade curriculum that will be taught in the Willamina School District this spring to see how it works, and we hope it'll run out to other tribes. And we've actually hired a curriculum specialist at Grand Ronde to keep that curriculum going. So it's something we really believe in. The history of Oregon did not start with the arrival of Lewis and Clark. It was occurring for thousands of years before they set foot on our land, and many of those Indian braves, warriors, and chiefs are worthy of being honored as the high school mascots. Let's work on something that truly makes a difference for the benefit of tribes and all Oregonians. Let's take a long and serious look at teaching all of our Oregon students about the history and culture of Oregon's 9 unique sovereign governments. If more Oregonians were educated about tribal history, sovereign social society, and culture, it wouldn't do much more to solve the problem attributed to Indian mascots than simply outlawing the practice. And I would just like to follow up on Justin's statement And when you really look at it, that's what we would like to say. So we got a school, Amity Warriors, 25 miles from where we live. It should be up to our cultural department to take that name, look at it in the history of the tribe and the land, and decide, is that derogatory, is it bad, and have that agreement with that school. And it's the same for any of the other tribes with schools that are named that way. We all have cultural departments. We all have history. We can make them calls. It should be up. Nobody can tell us our history better than us. And I'm open to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Well, I appreciate your thoughtful testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, John Dossett from the National Congress of American Indians.
Hi, how are you?
We have a video.
Sure. My name is John Dossett. Thanks for having me here today. I'm an attorney with the National Congress of American Indians based out of Washington, D.C. I actually live in Portland, Oregon, so I was close by. NCAI has for many years opposed the use of Native American mascots and images in sports, I think since about 1968. And recently, there's been quite an effort on the national level, and I guess that's what I was just here to talk about, is a little bit what I was asked to talk about anyways, about the sort of the national campaign on Indian mascots. I think we had a video of some of the work that we've done. There's a Washington football team that has quite a renowned name, and so some of the work that we've done recently, I think we're going to show that now if we could get some help on that. It's only 2 minutes long, so it'll be really quick.
Proud, forgotten, Indian, Navajo, Blackfoot, Inuit, and Sioux, survivor, spiritualist, patriot, Sitting Bull, Hiawatha, and Jim Thorpe. Mother, father, son, daughter, chief, Apache, Pueblo, Choctaw, Chippewa, and Crow, underserved, struggling, resilient, Squanto, Red Cloud, Tecumseh, and Crazy Horse, rancher, teacher, doctor, soldier, Seminole, Seneca, Mohawk, and Creek, Mills, Will Rogers, Geronimo, unyielding, strong, indomitable. Native Americans call themselves many things. The one thing they don't.
Well, that's it. That was a video that we didn't actually have the money to put it on actual commercial on Super Bowl Sunday, but that we released it on that day. And I think the point of the video, we have copies of the NCAA resolution on this subject. Did you guys get copies of that? Copies, but here, thank you. And I also, we also have a report on the subject that I thought I'd share with you. The point of the resolution and our report is that these mascots reinforce stereotypes, and the stereotypes, if you look at the video, I mean, Native people are very diverse. There's a whole lot of different Native people who do a whole lot of different jobs, and stereotyping them into one role is difficult, and this is true not just for Native people, but for all kinds of stereotypes. The warrior stereotype was originally used in this country to reinforce, you know, the mass killings of Native people all over the country. There's definitely been studies that show the negative effect on school children, and that was a very important point that's really, the membership of NCAI is really concerned about the effects on school children. Thirdly, that it's a barrier to individuals who are, seeking jobs, perhaps as a computer programmer or a reliable employee. If they a stereotyped image of a warrior or a savage warrior is going to be a negative image for that. And then that was the overall concern that has been expressed repeatedly in these NCAI resolutions. Typically the opponents of the proponents of the mascots, argue that they promote a tradition, and you can see that with a Washington football team as well. But that's something that NCAI has opposed very much. What you'll see in the resolution, though, and I wanted to bring this to your attention because I think it's what you're arguing, or at least having a discussion about here in the state of Oregon, is about the namesake exception. What about the local tribe? When this came up at NCAI had for many years opposed or asked the NCAA to ban the use of Native mascots in collegiate sports, and they proposed a ban. And then the Seminole Tribe of Florida came to NCAI, I believe this was in 2005, and the Seminole Tribe of Florida had a good relationship with the local university, the Florida State University of Florida State Seminoles. I think they won the national championship this year, so you're probably familiar with the name. And they wanted to make clear that if the local tribe had the right for their own namesake tribe to share that name with a local university or with a school, and NCAI supported that by resolution. NCAI is a tribal government organization, and we very much support tribes and tribal leaders and what their views are. So that's in the resolution, and we asked the NCAA to amend its policy so that a local namesake tribe could support that name. And that's been the position of NCAI, and there are two or three colleges around the country, like the Florida Seminoles, who have those names and have a good relationship with their local tribe. On this issue, here we are in the state of Oregon, and this is an issue that affects local tribes. NCI is very much going to encourage consultation with the tribes in Oregon. There's 9 tribes in Oregon. Talk to the Oregon tribes, and we'd encourage you to get their views and listen to their advice on this subject. We're definitely not here to take a position on the legislation one way or the other, but mostly just wanted to provide a little bit of context about the national debate over mascots and how that's playing out.
John, I appreciate that. In fact, I think just before you came in, we asked Yadamo if that dynamic could be replicated here in Oregon. And the dilemma that we have when you look at this very diverse panel up here, 5 guys over 50 who are white, is that I know all of us want to do what's best for Oregon and do the right thing, even sometimes when we disagree on issues. But when we see... when we hear conflicting testimony on this bill before us from Native American leaders, such as the witnesses who came before you, it leaves us flummoxed. And so I value very much the research that's out there, and we're just really trying to do the right thing. But there's conflicting messages coming from some NCAI members.
Right.
The problem.
I don't know that. Keep consulting with the tribes is great, and I know that we often wind up in these same positions at NCAI. You may have tribes that disagree with each other, but if you just keep grinding away on it, oftentimes you do find common ground. So I hope you find that here as well.
But it sounds actually like this bill does a lot what you did with the NCAA. It allows the local tribe to work with the local schools to come up with appropriate. Uses of either as mascot imagery and other things, because I look at the Seminoles as a good example to me. I understand that the tribe said using our name is fine, but the imagery that they use, if you watch their tribal things, I would contend is not similar imagery, because the Seminoles did not have horses. That was not their main transportation, as I understand the history, and I looked into that tribe a long time ago because I was very interested in the fact that it's one of the few tribes that doesn't have a treaty with the U.S. and because they continued to not need a treaty with the U.S. Watching things that were happening, they have this person ride in a horse and do all the other kind of stuff in Native American garb. Apparently, from the NCAA, that's okay as well, because that tribe has said our deal, and they have approved that image. So I don't see a lot of difference between that and what this bill does with respect to expecting any local district that wants to have and keep a title or an image, but they will work with their local tribe, one of the nine that are recognized in Oregon, to come up with some kind of an agreement. So to me, it looks like it's the same thing. I don't know that the bill is doing much different than that. So I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate this. And I am concerned about making sure that we make sure that every Oregonian, native or otherwise, has the best opportunity to be successful in our schools. And that's something that's really important to me. And I don't want to do anything that would harm the effectiveness of schools in helping kids reach their potential. So I'm trying to come to grips with how do we go about doing what it appears your organization and NCAA have come together on, and how we get that same thing to happen.
That is how we dealt with it at the NCAA level. And came to that agreement. I can't say that it was entirely without controversy.
Oh, I'm sure it wasn't.
that's where we wound up after a lot of discussion. Really a couple of years worth of work.
Yeah. Well, to his question, that is there any parallel between what this legislation seeks to do and the national policy that your organization agree to?
I think it's, in many ways, you're right, it's very similar. The question, I suppose, is that at least the tribes that have come up have been like the Florida Seminole and the Chippewas and, tribes that namesake exceptions, tribes whose name itself was the issue and the local tribe. And I think it sounds like that's what you're wrestling with here. NCAI is a tribal organization. We'd urge you to consult with the local tribes and work with them and get their advice.
I would say that's not exactly the same as we have here. It would be in one case in particular, from my perspective, because one of them is a tribal school. So to me, that one would be an exception. But the others had the tribal names, as the Seminoles did before, without that. But the local tribes have said, we would love to work with them to come up with an appropriate symbolization with respect to some of the same names. So it's a bit different than the Seminoles coming into this one, but I think it comes from the same basic belief structure. My feeling is that it comes from the same basic belief structure. In talking to the tribes that are in my district who have indicated that they think that this is something we can move towards.
Working with the local tribes on these issues is going to, I've been surprised again and again, tribes come up with good solutions on problems over and over. So I think you can trust them on that.
I agree. Trusting is important.
Further questions? Okay, John, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for coming down. We still have a fair number of people to go through, so I will urge you to be brief. Dr. Samuel Henry with the State Board of Education.
Good afternoon. I will be brief.
Thank you.
For the record, good afternoon, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Knopp, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Samuel D. Henry, EDD. I currently serve as chair of the Oregon State Board of Education, and I am testifying on behalf of the State Board of Education, which in May 2012 passed a ban on Native American mascot use in schools. My testimony today would have you reject the currently proposed legislation 1509 on three grounds. The State Board of Education during winter and spring of 2012 did due diligence, including public hearings and gathering testimony from about 150 persons. We found that the use of Native American mascots had not produced any positive educational effects for Native American students or other students of color, And we came to believe that without such a ban, the state might face costly legal challenges pursuant to the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1964 and other legislation. Due diligence. Following public testimony from students who had been verbally and physically harassed from reports that originated in 2006, in 2012, the State Board of Education heard testimony from several experts, including Charles Brown, Ph.D. from Lewis and Clark College, and Stephanie Freiberg, Ph.D. from Arizona State University, about the negative effects of the use of Native American mascots. We and some of us are in our day jobs, professors and capable and competent in reviewing research, and there were no research payoffs, if you will. We found persuasive effects from the research. Dr. Brown, a nationally known psychologist who has been a member of the NCAA investigating committee that testified to abolish Native American mascot use by colleges and universities, cited dozens of studies and explained the conclusions of the 2005 NCAA report in great detail, with little reason to question the NCAA conclusion of banning use of Native American mascot use. Dr. Freiberg, a distinguished Native American scholar and sociologist, detailed multiple high-quality social science studies on the effect of stereotype threat and other education and self-esteem defeating phenomena that result from the use of Native American mascots, stereotypes, and their use as mascots, caricatures, and social put-downs. We further heard testimony from both Native American community members and several busloads of Caucasian students brought to the Capitol, I believe to this hearing room here, from school districts who currently use Native American mascots. We then took testimony from a variety of civic, civil rights, and community groups. The preponderance of evidence led to our board conclusion and mascot ban vote. One memorable piece of evidence came from a public hearing when questioned, neither students, nor teachers, nor state legislator could name the local tribe whose mascot likeness they wished to use. I hear from being in the audience that that has changed. That pleases at least those of us on the board. Number two, lack of positive educational effects, what I think is the heart of the matter. The schools and universities in the state of Oregon, in spite of the good works of many on this committee, are just beginning to detail, and educational institutions are striving to emerge from two decades of long decline. I need not detail lost ground here, but their significance is such that we find no positive educational impact for schools that have used Native American mascots in these areas. High school matriculation, scores on OAKS and other assessments, high school graduation rates, transition to post-secondary education, completion of associate degrees, workforce training, or the receipt of bachelor's degrees. When you compare those mascot schools to similarly situated non-mascot schools. This is especially true when one looks at the aforementioned assessment indicators for Native American youngsters. From our review of the data, we conclude that the use of mascots has only resulted in negligible or null educational benefits for Native American children and youth, some of our most at-risk students in the state. Some academics and policymakers might pose that a positive gain for the local communities using a Native American mascot should build social and educational capital. We have not seen evidence of that building social capital. Third and last point, risk assessment. The coffers of the state education fund are precious. Every dollar needs to address curriculum improvement, preschool funding, professional development for teachers and educational personnel, outdated physical plants and technology, neglected teacher education, and a dozen other deserving areas. If this legislation passed as currently written, we risk lawsuits due the possibility of lawsuits to increase and court responses to bias that inherently lowers local autonomy. Community and federal and state court challenges will likely result with in-house attorney's fees and legal challenge prep work paid by scarce state dollars that could be spent elsewhere. As a veteran of school desegregation and proven bias work during the 1970s, and I did attend the Office for Civil Rights Academy and can assure you that I have used their methodology in determining bias in multiple situations, I will assure you that defense of such challenges backed by state law will be expensive, and potential instances where defense results from official government action may lead to a reduction in district autonomy. So one question for state legislators is, do you want to buy more kindergarten teachers, or do you want to pay for attorney's fees and staff time? It's that simple. We at the State Board were clear on the bias inherent in the use of Native American mascots in public school. I'll repeat that. We at the State Board were clear on the bias inherent in the use of Native American mascots in public school. Hence, our policy advice to you is that prior to legislative approval, these issues should be addressed. If there are questions, I will try to respond at this time.
Professor Henry, thank you. Yes. I think it was great that you managed to come down on PSU Day. At the same time.
I did know, Senator Haas, members of the committee, I did
it
know
is PSU Day.
That
Senator
was happening. I'm on
time.
Sabbatical this year and sort of okay. Lost track of some of those, but I usually bring a group of doctoral students down to see their government at work.
I have one question, and it has frustrated me since we got into this conversation. I've been on the Legislative Committee on Indian Services for the last number of years, and the governors have been consistent over the last since ATIA that state agencies, when making decisions, should get counsel from that group. We have a person who's on staff here who's always available, and we have all 9 federally recognized tribes there, so we can actually have a conversation about those issues based on those. It never came from the department. There was never a question back to LCIS, nor, in my understanding, to any one of the tribes who we are supposed to have relationships with, to be engaged in this conversation as the State Department was making it. And so, to me, it seems like it was a direct disconnect between the Department of Ed and, I think, a standing policy of all of our executive branch officers that they would be directly discussed with when making decisions based on things that could be of import to them, and they were. My understanding is they were never were. So if there was apparently one conversation back in 2004, I believe, with the education group, a subgroup of all the tribes that meet together, that it came up at one time in some conversation, but never again was it brought back to the tribes themselves or to the functioning group at LCIS. So I just wanted to know if there was a reason for that, if it was an oversight. What happened with respect to that new way that we're supposed to be doing intergovernmental conversations?
Chair Haas, Senator Roblin, 3 quick points. Number one, we dropped the ball. We dropped the ball in 2005, and we being the State Board of Education. We should have continued to have further conversations, and that is regrettable. Number two, there was an extensive involvement process when we, in 2012, considered the ban, and members of a variety of both federally recognized tribes and non-federally recognized tribes, which we won't get into a whole discussion here, were consulted and a part of the process, the testimony process. The third point that I would make in response to you is that we need to do a better job, both in terms of education in our state about Native Americans and about what we do on policy levels about Native Americans. For the most part, the board that is presently I'm the oldest, not oldest, I won't use that, although I may be
longest
close
serving.
There. Wow. Longest serving, and I was appointed in 2010. We have changed the board. There are some wonderful people who served on the board over the years, but we have a different focus at this point, and one of the foci is to be more appropriate with respect to consultation in terms of tribes in terms of our policy making. We are trying to make up for some lost time. We held our our first meeting on tribal land with the Grand Ronde tribe in April. And we are attempting in some ways to make some penetration into this. We have not taught Native American education well. We have not taught Native Americans well. We have disgraceful data that show that that has happened. We believe it must take place at multiple levels, and I would apologize for the work that we have done before in not addressing concerns from tribal members.
Professor, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
We have some other.
Thank you for listening.
I do want to call up Robert Kenda from the Siletz tribe. Thank you for being patient.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Haas, Senator Roblin, rest of the committee members. I apologize for my casual attire. I got the notice of this hearing at 11:30 today and left my desk at Siletz and did my best to make it here by 1 o'clock.
You look more comfortable than we are.
Thank you. First, I would like to say that I have in my possession a letter signed by four of the Oregon tribal chairs.
Can you start off with your ID, please?
Oh, excuse me. My name is Robert Kenta. I have been the cultural resources director for the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians for about 20 years, and I am just entering my 10th year of serving consecutively on the Siletz Tribal Council as an elected member. I am a member of the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians. I attended Siletz School from grade 1 through 12, graduated from Siletz High School as a Siletz warrior, and I think the issues that have been discussed today get jumbled. There are some very egregious examples in the nation. The Washington Redskins is one of those. There's no way that that can be defended as a non-discriminatory, non-derogatory term. We don't have that situation in Oregon. We have fairly innocuous references to tribes. Roseburg Indians is one of those. The Siletz Warriors is one of those. And we are a tribal community. We are a tribal community school. And over 60% of our student body are descendants or tribal members themselves, of descendants of other tribes even. We have a majority of the student body that are Native. And as I started to say, I have in my possession a letter signed by at least four of the Oregon tribal chairs, and I understand that at least two more are ready to sign on. And that's why it hasn't been circulated so far. But I do have the copy with the four tribal chairs, which I will hand over. And that letter is in support of the current bill being considered. We believe that it is a very common sense approach dealing with the issue. I believe that the mascot ban itself does not address racism, stereotypes, and all the other issues that a lot of this discussion sprang out of initially. Our tribes have suffered a lot in our history, and to some degree, you as state legislators are probably more aware of that history than the general Oregon public. A lot of the issue is we need Oregon-based curriculum in the schools, addressing our history as Oregonians as a whole and the tribal histories. Taking away mention of Indians in schools is not an approach that we think is productive towards that conversation of needed curriculum and education on racism, stereotypes, and Oregon tribal governments and their role in Oregon today. I also have a kind of a petition letter signed on by many of the student body of the Siletz Charter School, and I will turn that over, as well as a individual letter to the governor signed by an individual student.
Thank you for those documents. We are about to lose our room here.
Okay. Yes, I will wind it up. I just encourage speedy action on the bill, and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Oh, one quick thing I need to say is if the bill could be improved upon, it is to make it more consistent with the cultural resource law in Oregon. where it states that more than one tribe may be consulted. The geographically closest tribal headquarters of today may not even be the appropriate tribal group representative to the original tribal people of the land the school sits on. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Committee, we are not going to take a vote on this bill today, and we will carry over Senate Bill 1509 to Thursday, along with 1566. I still think there is some work that could be done to get to a middle ground. I know it's out there. I talked to both sides last week, and I know the governor's office is working diligently today, so we will wait and see. So I will close our public hearing and work session on 1509, and I will adjourn our committee. Thank you. Grab some of this.